Wait, wait, stop, that's the one.
Welcome to Zenten Speaks, a show where I make new friends and reconnect with old ones. A show where everyone's stories may inspire you to tell your own story. In this podcast, we encourage everyone to get rid of shame, guilt, fear, doubt, and judgments for themselves and for others, and replace those with love, empathy, compassion, understanding, kindness, and to do your best in everything that you do. In essence, to get rid of things that no longer serve your well-being, to be true to yourself and be honest with others. So what is the practice of yoga and why is it important in someone's life?
Okay, this is a great question. So I've been teaching the yoga for 15 years. And I guess students, what kind of yoga do you teach? Now, the first five times I got asked that question, I think the first time I was like, oh, well, I teach, you know, this type of yoga, or I teach this type of yoga. Then after contemplating it for about 10 years, there's only one yoga. So Raja Yoga is the only yoga. You can Bhakti Yoga, Devotional Yoga, Hatha Yoga, this yoga. Hatha Yoga still teaches the eight limbs. So Hatha Yoga was based more for younger people, and it was harnessing the younger people's energy and channeling it into asana so that they can meditate at early ages. But they're still studying the eight limbs of yoga. So the eight limbs of yoga are to be studied. In the yoga that I teach, there are 1,260 asanas. So the asana can get very advanced in the yoga that I teach, but you don't need to do all of these incredible asanas to do yoga. But there are about 20 to 30 asanas that you should have in your practice that are going to keep your body healthy and functional until you live a very long time. Mm-hmm. The goal of yoga, yuj, is very simple: to liberate your soul from suffering and to become one with the wholeness of totality. That's what yoga is.
Mm-hmm. So if someone, let's say someone, well, I don't know about her, but the lady who just died, let's say Betty White, she had never done yoga and she's like, I live that long. Like, what's the point?
The question is how did she die? So when she died, was she conscious of the next trip? You know, obviously Betty White is a pretty advanced spiritual person. She went through, you know, the point where she had the black dancer on her show, and then they said not to bring him back, and she brought him back like four or five times. So so Betty White is obviously a pretty special type of person to think about. But when it comes time to bardo, the last thing that happens is you exhale. Then when you exhale, the soul leaves the body. So how conscious are you when the soul leaves the body? And are you taking that karma with you into the next life, into the next birth? The Buddha didn't want to be reborn again, so he released all of his earthly attachments. When his soul left his body, he never reincarnated, but his soul still exists in the middle of his own multiverse. So Buddha released all his attachments. His energetic body still exists, and he's in the center of a whole multiverse. So with one thought, he can just create a universe. Like, that's the type of power you're talking about. The thing that makes what I teach, which is Raja Yogang, a little bit different, is it focuses on longevity techniques. So it's unseen how long that you can live in a human body. And if you practice the techniques that I'm going to be teaching, be on the lookout for my next book, The Immortal Practices, you could live to be very, very old. Now, when I get into this topic, I'm very, if people are just seeing me now, people will write you off. In the Qigong Taoist text, it says one of the masters lived to be 800. If you look online, in 1956, I believe, one of the Qigong masters lived to be over 200 years old, 246 years old. If you look in the Bible, it says man used to live to be 1,200 years old. Then in one chapter in the Bible, man goes from 1,200 years old to living to be 120 years old. Then if you look in the Breatharian text, it says the reason why man dropped from that type of age length was because he kept eating gross, heavy foods, and that brought man away from the light and brought him down into the earth, and that's what shortened his time. But now with what I teach, I'm marrying the ancient techniques along with the modern sciences for advanced techniques that humankind has never seen before. And I teach these techniques. Many of them are on my channel. So it's unseen how it works. And it's unclear as far as karma goes and the state of the world that these techniques are going to get to that level. But at least 120 years of happy life. And then good karma, and then you pass. If you're realized and you're doing your meditation, you have a choice. If you're not realized, you go through life doing carnal pleasures, carnal things, no spirituality, then you, when you leave the body, you're adrift with your karma. And even worse, if you're not practicing morality, if you're going through life harming other beings without caring, without showing anything, in the next life you get reborn into severe suffering to where you're the person who's now getting harmed over and over again. So I think that's very important for people to understand. But a conscious exit and meditation on death are deep parts of the spirituality as far as the Buddhist and yogic lineages go. Most people don't want to talk about death. They just want to keep indulging in pleasure so that they don't have to face the realities of life. And if you do that, then when it's your time to go, you have no control.
Why is most teaching is about rewards and punishment? Is it because it's part of life?
What it says here is the negative actions are reborn with pain, and the positive actions are rewarded with merit. So it's just every action you take is either good or bad, and the good actions are reward and the bad actions come to merit. But it does say the yogi rises above these. So if you're practicing your meditation, you're no longer subject to the punishment. Of course, you can't do anything harmful to beings.
Right, yeah.
But the...
Is that the universe law then?
The laws that are embedded in the universe, they're not going to change. And the law of cause and effect, it's the first law, and it's also the law of science. So the three universal laws are... the first one is that nothing in the universe is lost. Everybody you've ever loved, every good deed you've ever done, nothing is ever lost in the universe. The second one is the law of impermanence. Nothing in the universe is permanent. Everything is in a state of energetic flux. And the third one is the law of cause and effect. So whatever you do is going to come back to you. That's just how it works.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to say was, it says, otherwise the soul identifies with fluctuating consciousness. Then it says, the fluctuations in the consciousness are five in origin. They may be detectable or hidden, painful or painless. They are caused by right knowledge, wrong knowledge, delusion, sleep, and remembrance of things past. The sources of correct knowledge are direct perception, logical reasoning, and factual text. Wrong knowledge originates from a distorted understanding of what is real. Uncertainty arises when knowledge is based on words alone and is devoid of reality as its basis. So when I'm speaking to you, I can see you're looking back in your past experiences. Okay, you know what? What he's saying is right. I can base that on my past experiences. So if you take things on blind faith and you don't put them in with your past experiences, that's wrong. So faith should be built through personal experiences. But faith does not mean closed-mindedness, and that's what I really want people to understand. So many times, that's a belief, or that, no, it's not a belief. This is fact. This is not my opinion. This is actual fact. Then at that point, if you want to debate about it, okay, debate's okay. But if you get angry, yell, argue, don't want to listen, you're not willing to change a little bit, then that's stubbornness. So now you're going to cause not only your own suffering, but everybody else's suffering as well.
Yeah.
Dreamless sleep is the mind state that is absent of perception. Memory is the unaltered remembrance of words and experiences. One more. Repeated practice and non-attachment control these five fluctuations of the mind. So this one's important. Repeated practice and non-attachment control these five fluctuations. So the fluctuations in the brain, you're looking to calm them and still them. And the only way to do that is by doing your meditation and slowly detaching from the earthly stuff. And the next one is effort towards steadiness of mind is practice. So that's where the yoga, the top three limbs are what constitute yoga. The previous limbs are like a precursor and a foundation so that you can practice the top three limbs.
Mm-hmm. I have practiced the non-attachment of things, and I've noticed with the emotions, for some reason that was harder. I guess like all different people is different. Some people maybe things is harder, emotion is fine. But then with the emotion, that's when I had more challenging and I had to work harder. Because like since I could remember when I was a kid in the, I grew up Jehovah's Witness, so I like to say hall. But in the hall would be like, hey, I want this. And I'll be like, sure, have it. And my parents would be like, I paid good money for this. And they're like, are you giving your stuff away all the time? Because I had to, I was like, if they enjoy it so much, they can have it. And I heard Sadhguru says that none of us own anything. We just placing things from here and there. So therefore, why you're so upset something happened? Of course, you might be upset because you work. My sir owes me $40,000. And then eventually I got over it. And thinking about it now, I don't have any, like, there's not even emotion, good or bad. It just was, is. Of course, I would like it to get paid back. But I don't have any resentment or hate for her. Although she feels that way because I'm not talking to her. But I tell her, I'm not talking to you. Not because we talk, but we're not like friends. It's not because of that. It's just the integrity. And if people, I also had to do that with my friends because like I'm such a giver. My first love language is acts of service. I'm a giver. Then people will take advantage. They don't know when to stop. And I'm like, yeah, I can give you, but if you deplete somebody, then that's an issue. And so I have no, it's not a challenge for me to give up things or have non-attachment. But with the emotions, I used to, of course, like most people will say, he made me feel that way or this made me feel this way. But now I'm like taking a control of my emotions. And when something happened, I'm going to be like, I feel this way because of me or my thoughts. So what is the practice of Qigong and why it's important in someone's life?
Qigong is the study of energy, how it flows through the universe and how it flows through your body. And specifically, how to cultivate that energy for health and longevity and to reach spiritual enlightenment. And if you're looking to take your health to the next level, Qigong is a must.
Mm-hmm. So are there two types of Qigong? Because I remember I did more of these things when I lived in Boston. How we were in a class and they did that doll. Is that Qigong too?
I'm not sure.
Okay, because when I Googled it, it looks like Qigong is the, when you're doing this, like when you stand up, you're doing that thing.
Oh, Tai Chi. Yeah. So
what is Qigong? You tell me.
So it's the study of energy, how it flows to the universe and how it flows to your body. What you're talking about is the physical practices. The Qigong is non-martial, whereas Tai Chi has martial applications, and Tai Chi came along later in the timeline. Qigong was first invented when the working class in China started to become sick, and the royal class asked the spiritual masters to help the sick people out, and the sick people, the masters put together Qigong to help them to create space in their spinal column and allow the energy to flow through their spine. And then the spiritual class basically cured the whole working class through the practice of Qigong. But Qigong later became how to cultivate your internal energy so that you can reach spiritual enlightenment, and also longevity techniques. The longevity techniques are extremely important, and it depends on what level of a practitioner that you become, but they're breathing techniques and internal alchemical techniques which can allow you to live to be 100, 120, even so on and further than that.
Okay, so it's not like a...
Well, you're talking about like these movements and these
Yeah,
movements.
That's Qigong?
Yeah, that would be called, that's motion, Qigong.
Okay.
So, Neidan, Weidan, one of them you're focusing inside, the other one you're doing movements. So those are just gentle movements that you do to get the energy flowing through your body and keep the mind calm and have a little bit of physical motion.
Okay, because that's the one I know. And there's another one. Like, what's the other practice would be? Because what you explained, like, is it physical or is it a reading thing?
So you want to make sure you take care of both. The still meditation Qigong is going to cultivate the energy, the mind and the soul, the spirit. And then the moving Qigong helps with the physical body. So you need both. and we'll turn for yoga for that. The third asana, that's all you see us doing, the exercise, the yoga. So it really just comes down to having some kind of a physical exercise in your life where you're moving your body. And then, but the breathing techniques and the internal qigong is how to manipulate the energy within your body and how to cultivate qi within mm-hmm. your body so that you have vibrant qi, vibrant sexual energy, vibrant virility, so that you have you can get through life with less problems and you don't end up sick.
Nice. So tell us your practice of herbalism.
Oh, wow. So I actually look for my up-and-coming book, Holy Tonifying Herbalism. So I specialize in tonifying herbalism. Tonifying herbalism is herbs that you take that tonify your energy permanently, and they have little to no adverse effects. And if you take these herbs with your qigong practice, the longevity and the health that you get from it are immeasurable. There's about 80 herbs, and if you put these herbs into your herbal rotation and you take them, you can get 20 to 40 more years out of your body. And in those 20 to 40 years, there's a lot less sickness, because these herbs, they boost up your immune system, they boost up your overall health, they boost up your overall longevity. I'll just name five herbs. Of course, ginseng is the king. Ginseng is the undisputed king. Ashwagandha, Gotu Kola, Moringa, Oolong. We'll name these five. But if you drink these teas, they will tonify your energy. And there's herbs that are for the kidneys. There's herbs that are for the sexual fluids. There's herbs that are good for the skin. There's herbs that are good for the hair. So if you take these 80 herbs, the health benefits are just, they're fantastic. And it even says in the sutras that the taking of the herbs is one of the things that can get you to enlightenment faster.
Nice. Yeah, I can totally feel that when I switch doing all this herbal stuff. I feel so much cleaner and better, and mentally too.
Yeah.
Because once you mentally feel clean there, then you're going to be more aware and self-awareness to do body stuff and do better.
The mind is, the consciousness is its contents, so, mm-hmm. so as long as you're not blocking anything out, the mind is experiencing everything.
Yes, definitely. And as you mentioned, with eating non-animal products, totally. I did different kind of diets, and I've noticed the difference there, definitely. And of course, working out and making sure you do yoga and meditation, those totally improve one's life.
The eating of meat, number one, you're killing an animal. That's number one. For me, I went into my first 2 years of vegetarianism with moral reasons, and it was a tough 2 years. Mm. My body felt off. I didn't feel right. It was a real struggle. It's not easy for some people. Then I went back to eating meat, and I ended up feeling even worse than how I felt before. Then I went back to being vegetarian. So it took me, I did the first 2 years cold turkey, no meat. I went back to eating, then I went meat, then I went back to being vegetarian, and now my body doesn't miss it at all. So a lot of people, they say, well, my body craves it, and they have lineage, which is very heavy meat eating lineage, and that's in your DNA,
uh-huh.
it's in your being. So it's definitely challenging to do, to turn over to being vegetarian. But the fact of the matter is, number one, it is healthier to be a vegetarian if you do it over time.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, if you're killing and slaughtering an animal, that reason right there is the cause of all suffering, because you're harming something in your environment, which is harming you. So the transition to go from getting over the cravings to go into being vegetarian, that type of sacrifice and pain that you go through for more health and to help the killing and the suffering on earth will give you a lot of dedication and a lot of strength in your good deeds, in your auspiciousness. And it said, don't talk about not harming things when there's a dead animal on your plate.
Mm. Right, yeah. So how about people, because I used to be vegan and I joined the PETA group, and I don't join groups anymore because I've noticed crazy stuff happening. So, because I did it for more reason, I joined PETA, you know PETA, the organization that often go protest and they're, mm. yeah.
And so, and but later on, I've noticed, like, so there are some cultures, I don't know if they still exist, but back then, like, example, if they're in Antarctica, they have to eat the seal, and that's their staple. Like, because I have to ask these questions, and no one have an answer, and I get it, and I totally agree with you, definitely. Mm. Like, we live in New York. You don't need to go and kill a seal to eat it. But yeah, what do you think?
So for the people who are up there eating the seals for survival, it's an absolute must, and that had to happen in the evolution of the humankind. But now with the advent of technology, we can build a solar-powered greenhouse to where those people can completely live off the sun and grow their own food. So it really comes down to, are we going to use the technology that we have for the betterment of all people, or is the technology going to turn greed-based to where the technology isn't even improving the qualities of human life?
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely, if you have to kill an animal to survive, absolutely, definitely do it. But now that we're evolving as a species, we have trade routes, we have internet, we have more knowledge, we have more species, we should be evolving past it.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I've done catering, and a thing I've did to myself, I was like, if I'm at work, I'm not gonna starve myself, because I've seen other vegans, they're starving, they work 12 hours, and I was just like, well, to each their own, but I'm not gonna go in that route. If there's chicken served, I'm gonna eat
always it. Always put the health first. Your health should be your first priority. You should never be denying your health, but vegetarianism is better for you than meat. So it's just the transitional period.
Right.
Do you have the strength to get through the transitional period? Somebody I was just speaking with had Argentinian background, and they eat beef 2 times a day, and their ancestors have eaten nothing but beef for thousands of years. So the type of change that person has to go through to go into a vegetarian is very difficult for him, whereas other people who don't have that type of lineage, it might not be that difficult. But can he go through it? Yes, everybody can.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, do you have the type of dedication and merit, and do you care enough about the animals to not do it?
Definitely. Yeah. Right. What is the essence of Yoga Sutra? And what is a sutra?
Yeah, this is a great question. So the essence of the Yoga Sutras is to realize the soul and let go of all earthly attachments and become one with the wholeness of totality. That's what the Yoga Sutras is.
Mm.
What was the second question?
What is the essence of Yoga Sutra, and what is a sutra? Because people are like, what is a sutra?
A sutra is a thread. It's a piece of information. So even what I'm telling you right now, it's information that goes into you, and that information leads up to a certain thing. So the threads build up, and they make a beautiful blanket, and that beautiful blanket is Kaivalya, liberation. It teaches you how to free yourself from all earthly attachments and desires and reach a higher state of consciousness in which you become spiritually fulfilled.
Nice. I love that very much. And especially, I haven't practiced on your level, but I've tasted it, and it tastes really great. And so it's like, every time I wake up, I'm like, why go back? And when I've gone back on certain things, I know it doesn't feel good, and it tastes gross. So I'm like, why would I ever go back into... Once you know, you have to do better.
Backstepping is a hindrance on the spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
So it says slipping from ground gained is a hindrance.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as you evolve, then you don't want to slip back into your old habits.
Yeah.
And that's where your meditation practice and anchoring in your spiritual evolution in with your meditation is extremely important. Otherwise, you're taking 2 steps forward, 2 steps back, 2 steps forward, 2 steps back. So it's better to go 1 step forward every day, nice and slowly over time, than it is to rush to the end, and all of a sudden you end up back in the beginning. So.
Yeah, in the beginning, I think a lot of people, when they find out spirituality, they do that rush, which I do that as well. And I've noticed life would do the same. I was like, oh, I guess it's a thing.
It's better to rush than it is not to do anything.
yeah, certainly. Well, you already mentioned it in a sense where how Yoga Sutra will end suffering. So, okay, so I've actually, when I was reading the stuff you sent me, and I remember reading the Book of Joy by Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, and he was saying how desire is a cause of suffering, and I know it, anything is possible in this life. I know it, definitely. At the same time, in my mind, I'm like, I don't think in my lifetime, and it could be a wrong thing to say.
Okay.
But it's something it's there, so I'm going to say it. I don't think in my lifetime I'm going to see paradise or end of suffering because of how human are. Every day, of course, like 2020, like we're better than we were 200 years, 300 years, 1,000 years, of course. But I feel like in my lifetime, no, like some people, I think in 2008, probably, I don't remember when Obama was president, people who are old, they're like, oh, wow, I didn't think we have a black president. But for me and my generation, I knew it would happen because it's just like different mindset and different generation. For them, they're like, oh, my God, I'm so shocked. But for me, I was just like, oh, okay, sure, whatever. So maybe in your generation, like mentally or where you are in your work, it is I know it's possible, but I feel like, eh, not in my lifetime.
Goodness is like drops of water. Eventually, one drop of water will fill up a jar.
Mm-hmm.
So you do the good that you can in life. And if you can't do good, and if you can't change it, don't worry about it. But you're developing your inner self so that you're less and less affected by what's happening outside of you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Totally. And I've done that somewhat in my life, and I can feel the difference. And definitely that does work. Yeah. Wow. And so this is your translation of the sutra?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Mm-hmm. As you're... Because I know you say you're an author. I don't remember I saw your book, possibly. Maybe you sent it, but I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. And then when you had it in your hand, this is the book here. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh my God, I want one. So
yeah.
So tell us, why is it important for someone to read your translation?
Mm. So my translation has multiple lines or multiple translations for each sutra. So when Patanjali teaches us the sutra, he says that we should repeatedly study the sutras over and over again. And I studied the sutras at least 10 times before I read the translations. And the fact that it has multiple translations for each sutra allows you to grasp the concept of the sutra in the minimal amount of time. And I also put the best translation first. And I'm coming from an American perspective with a Christian-based and very deep-founded Buddhist and Taoist-based understanding and insight. So I'm bringing that into the translations when I teach them.
Okay, yeah. So... Can you, well, the audience can see it, but once you get the book, you'll see what I'm going to ask.
Okay.
Is there is like four lines, or in this one, there's four lines. Mm. So these are different translation that, so people can understand. Okay.
Exactly. If you look at Sanskrit, Pali, Greek, or Aramaic, back then the words were less defined and more expressive. The English language, when it came around, it makes the words more definitive. So you're able to describe things better, but you lose a certain amount of the expressiveness and the openness in it. So one Sanskrit word, for example, dukkha, can mean 20 different English words. So when you read the Sanskrit translation, it's very hard to give it to people in one line because there can be multiple different understandings in one line. Mm. So when I give anywhere from one to four translations for each line, it covers every aspect of the sutra so that you can understand basically everything that Patanjali was saying when he gave us the sutras.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I've noticed that when I Google, actually, especially when I Google the Bible, like a verse I had in my head, and it shows me different translations, and they all mean different.
28 translations.
Yeah, like Old English or current. I actually like the... I think called New Translation Modern or whatever. It's like plain language, and I'm like, good, I don't want to hear Thou, Thee, Dung. And I'm like, what does mean?
Yeah, it's funny. You go to read a translation of that. I recently just did a reading from the King James Version, and I started getting messed up because I was like, Thouist hasith, and I was like, uh-oh. I was like, let me go to the new translation of the King James Version, you know? Yeah.
Right. So, give the audience like a thorough introduction about your book, like how and why.
Let me read the first two sutras again. So the first sutra, Patanjali tries to sum up. So when you go to a master, you ask a master a question. The master doesn't want to overcomplicate it for you. So they went up to Patanjali, well, what is yoga? Patanjali answered the question this three words. Yoga happens now. Yoga is present in this moment. And that's it. That's yoga. There is no need for the other sutras after that. If you're completely and fully present,
you've graduated yoga, but we're made up of different aspects. We have psyche, we have intellect, we have personality, we have ego, eye consciousness, we have memory. So these split aspects of the mind keep the mind separate from the soul. In the Yoga Sutras, it's teaching you how to settle your mind back into your soul so that the mind and the soul become one, they become calm. And when they join together, that's what yoga is. Mm-hmm. The rest of the sutras are essential because it goes into the elements, it goes into all the other questions. It says, for example, life is a continuation of moments, but because of our psyche, we're either going into the future or we're going into the past. Mm-hmm. So it's actually our psychiatric qualities that keep us out of the present moment. But it says the yogi, fully realizing that all of the magic takes place in this moment, transcends the limitations of the linear mind by thinking that they cannot do something in the present moment. Right. See, now something right there, it's whoa, you know? And so then when you read it over and over again, it really anchors in really deep, because it's not easy to stay in the present moment all the time. And there's a lot of other things that happen. And this book covers every single angle. Mm. It's everything that you need to know about becoming realized and setting your soul free from earthly attachments. So to become liberated, a liberated being.
Nice. And that is possible to happen, definitely. Yeah. And it would be nice. I should get over it. But it would be... I'm attached to that part. It would be nice to know it will happen in my lifetime. Because obviously, if I'm practicing it myself... just realization. If I practice it myself, then it will be in my lifetime. Because I practice it.
It says, if you practice with fervent practice, if you really want to do it, you'll gain ground really quick. It says, if you half step and you do halfway, you'll get half gain. If you're like, la-di-da-di-da, you get no gain.
Yeah.
So it depends on how dedicated you are to your yoga practice.
So true. Oh my God, thank you for that.
You're welcome, bro.
Because I remember... probably because of my surroundings, and of course, myself as well, my fault. I used to, whenever something happened, or somebody like customer service, or what's it called? Those people who buy things. Customer. Mm. That people, like a young phrase, would say, I hate people. Mm. Oh, I hate people. Oh, people. Always blaming people and all this stuff. And then eventually, when I sit into myself, I was like, oh, I have all these expressions because I hate myself. I'm frustrated with myself. I'm annoyed about myself of the things that were into me. So when I started loving myself and have kindness and wisdom and patience and all these good qualities, then I was able to see it in someone else too. And empathy, when a customer behaves a certain way, I give them love because that's what was inside me. But when I didn't have love, I give them shit because... that's what I was inside. So yeah, that's definitely, I've just realized that.
these two sutras, 2.7, pleasure results in desire and emotional attachment. And then Sutra 2.8, the mental impressions left by pain result in hatred. Mm. Those two sutras are so important. Every time you feel pain, you hate. So it's to understand what is the cause of my hatred. And then you alleviate that pain. And that's where that deep inner heart and cleansing and healing comes into play, because the pain is surrounded in the heart and is that scar there. So what you're doing is you're healing that scar.
Mm-hmm. When I read your question and then you mentioned about Buddhism and yoga. Mm. So yoga comes from India. Mm-hmm. And so what's the difference between Buddhism and yoga? Like, I didn't think there was a difference, or there would be one.
Mm-hmm. All right, so this will be the last question. So
the
Buddha had the best education of his time. He was a prince. He probably had the best education than anybody ever before him in that time. So if you read the Four Noble Truths, the Four Noble Truths are in the Yoga Sutras. So if I was educated in Sankhya philosophy and I wanted to teach somebody who didn't know anything about Sankhya philosophy, I would start with the Four Noble Truths. So basically, if you ask me, Siddhartha gave a breakdown of the Yoga Sutras, which is basically in life there's suffering, suffering has a cause. You can be free from suffering, and this is how you become free from suffering. So if you ask me, Buddha was just teaching yoga, but he was fully realized Buddha. So that's the difference. But then the Buddhists, they wanted theirs to be different from the yogis, so they branched it off. But meanwhile, they're teaching basically the same thing. So that's why when you come back to the core text of the Yoga Sutras, you're teaching the fundamental foundation without putting your own greed and your own reasons on it. Because let's face it, people have to make money, people have to do this. So because of that, they want, no, this is mine. But it's the same difference. So in Buddhism, they say it's the jhana states. But in yoga, they say it's the samadhi states. So my question is, well, what's the difference between the jhana states and the samadhi states? There is none. Mm-hmm. They're talking about the same thing. It's just a different word because the Buddhists wanted to keep their lineage separate from the yogic lineages. So then you can become confused because there's so many texts. You got the Holy Bible. You got the Tao Te Ching. You got the Dhammapada. You got the Yoga Sutras. You got the Vedas, just to name some of them. So where do I begin? I'm overwhelmed. There's too many spiritual texts. I don't know what to study. So with the Yoga Sutras, it's only 196 sutras. So you can cover it in an hour or two. You can read it. And after doing all the research, reading the Buddhist text, studying into the lineage, is it right? Is it wrong? Is this a qualified text? Do I need to study this? Am I overkilling it? Do I need to study all these texts? This is a good place to start because it's the fundamental guide to self-realization with no bias at all.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. When I watch, what's this guy named? The Tao, like, who meant the Tao?
Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu?
Yeah, Lao Tzu, yeah. When I read his stuff, and I was like, I mean, I know the Bible stuff. I was like, I don't need the other stuff because this stuff is very direct and it's simple and makes sense. And if you just do it, then you don't need all these other practices and going to groups and doing extra, et cetera.
The in the yoga, Svadhyaya means study. So what it is to dedicate yourself to study. And it says specifically the spiritual text. So no matter how old you get, you can be fully enlightened Buddha, you're still at least supposed to study a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the religion, is to study.
Yeah. So where can someone find your book and find you so they can learn from you?
The book is available on Amazon. You can take another look at the cover. It's Master Vincent Ferrer Yoga Sutras. My YouTube channel is Wisdom Master Vincent Ferrer. And my Facebook page is Master Vincent Ferrer Raja Yogang. I'm going to put all the links to the descriptions below. Please like, subscribe, and share. And Zen, can you please tell about your YouTube channel as well, brother?
Oh, sure, definitely. So it's as Zenten Speaks. And if you go on YouTube, it's just going to be Zenten. So I like to make interviews like this, or even a chat. It doesn't feel like interviews, just like meeting new people and talk about themselves, and especially spiritual masters like Master Vincent here. And I'm so grateful that you give me your time and your space to talk about your book and what you've learned. And I'm so excited. I want to get a book, so you should get one too. Yeah, and we'll post the link on the description below. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for joining, guys. Zen, man. Thanks, bro.
Yeah, totally.
God bless, guys.